to ask Francine to come up here and share with us.
I was sort of prepared for you to talk longer. Hi, I'm Francine. I'm an alcoholic. And you see, I come armed, always. I've learned how to tear a little bit in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am Francine, and I am an alcoholic. And this is unbelievable. It really is. I want to just first thank the committee for inviting me to participate in this conference this weekend. I'm from the school in Alcoholics Anonymous that believes whenever I'm invited to speak anywhere, whether it's in a group of two people or a group of 2,000, that it's a privilege, that it's really a privilege. And especially considering where I've come from, it's even more a privilege because for most of my life, nobody was inviting me anywhere. And for good reason, because there was never anything that I had to offer. There was never anything positive that ever came out of my mouth, and I surely wasn't an example of health and a glowing woman. I wasn't any of that. But it's especially a privilege that they've invited me to speak here in Vegas this weekend because it's here 11 years ago that I got sober. And I know this is going to be the most emotional talk I've ever given. So let me just prepare you. It's here 11 years ago that I was given life. Literally given life. There are a lot of people that are sitting in the audience right now that picked me up and carried me and made me the woman that you see before you this morning. And I must tell you that the woman you see before you this morning is really become a special human being. And it started right here. It started because of you guys that cared enough to see beyond the anger and the hostility and the bad attitude that I came in with. You loved me until I was capable of loving myself truly, truly. And so this meeting this morning is really a dedication to you in Vegas who cared enough to just stick around. I'd like to welcome those that are relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous and say that you are truly in for perhaps the most phenomenal experience of your life, truly. And I know some of you that are real new are probably sitting here with your hands shaking and your palms sweating, and you're probably saying, yeah, right, you know. Or you perhaps had the worst night of your life last night, or you woke up this morning feeling really depressed and saying, yeah, right, it's easy for you to say. But I can tell you that perhaps it is easy for me to say today, but it wasn't so easy before. And yet a day at a time, I kept coming back. I'm one of those alcoholics that came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous strictly to stop drinking. It was that simple for me. I didn't come in because I wanted to learn how to drink more effectively. I didn't come in because I wanted to recover a spouse or a loved one. I didn't come in because the cops were on my tail. I didn't even come in because I wanted to be a better person. I came in because I was 26 years old, and I was dying. I was dying from alcoholism, and I just wanted to stop drinking. And what I found in the years that I've been around has been something surpassed that has not been surpassed by anything I could have ever imagined in my whole life, ever. In my wildest imaginings, I could not have manufactured what was to happen to me in the next 11 years. I just couldn't have done it. My brain was too limited. I couldn't have done it. I remember when I was newly sober, when I was in the middle of all that newcomer stuff, I remember saying to myself and to lots of other people, anybody that would listen, that, you know, if I knew what I was in for when I got sober, I would have never stuck around, or I'd have never come in. And I wouldn't have. But you know what? If I knew what I was in for short of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have come in. If I knew that this stuff was in store for me, you bet I'd do it all over again. I'd do it all over again. Because what I've gotten out of you in the years I've been around has just been so awesome. It has been so awesome. Today I'm the kind of woman that can look at herself in the mirror and love who she sees in that mirror. I respect myself as a woman today, and I didn't feel any of that stuff, and I didn't truly know any of that stuff when I came in here, but you taught me that, and for that I'm really, really grateful. I want to read something, and it is not AA-approved literature for those of you that are purists, but but this is a prayer that I used to read every morning at We Care, which is a facility here in Vegas. It's one of the prayers we used to read. It's entitled Living Sermon. I'd rather see a sermon than to hear one any day. I'd rather one would walk with me than merely show the way. I can soon learn how to do it if you'll let me see it done. I can watch your hands in motion, but your tongue too fast may run. All the lectures you deliver may be very wise and true, but I'd rather get my lesson by observing what you do. Though I may not understand you and the fine advice you give, there is no misunderstanding how you act and how you live. And you guys, a day at a time, have shown me how to act and how to live in a way that's very, very different from the way I was behaving when I crawled in here 11 and a half years ago. I was born almost 38 years ago, and that in itself blows me away, just to have that roll off my tongue. I mean, I'll be 38 in a month and a half, and that is really unbelievable. It is really unbelievable. I got sober at 26 years old, and I truly didn't think I was going to make it to my 27th birthday. And I'll tell you, had my drinking career not been cut short by Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have made it, because that's the kind of fast track I was on. I lived fast, and I lived hard. I grew up in the 60s, and it just seemed to all be so acceptable. And I didn't think I was going to make it in here, but I did. But what was really interesting, what I really remember about those early years for me, I was born in Atlanta, and I remember things like on Halloween, when I was a little girl, my grandfather would dress up like Jack-o'-lantern, and he'd wear this thing on his head, like a lantern, and cut the eyes out, and it was really fun. That was one of the fun memories I remember as being a child. He'd play with us, and he'd take us out trick-or-treating, my sister and I. And that was during the period when kids could go trick-or-treating and their parents didn't have to worry about the fruit or the candy being tainted with acid or some other kind of noxious poison. You didn't have to worry about sending your kids out because then you'd be afraid their necks might get sliced up. At that period, it was still a real fun period for me. And I also remember growing up in Atlanta, the lightning bugs. In New York, we don't have those things. At least I don't see them in the city. And I remember catching lightning bugs in a jar, and I remember marveling at those things because they actually could light up. I mean, as a kid, that fascinated the hell out of me, these little lightning bugs. And when I caught them all in the jar, I'd let them go. But the fascination was really to watch them light up, and then I'd let them go. I also remember looking at the stars. Another period in my life that was really fun, and it was still so innocent. I remember looking up at the stars and sort of picking out the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. And again, in New York, at least in the city, you can't see the stars. You can't see the stars from the tall buildings, but you can't see the stars from a lot of other stuff in the air. But I remember as a kid, I saw those stars, and it was really great. You know, it was really a lot of fun just to pick them out, the constellations. I remember Christmas. Christmas was fun, and even though we grew up very, very poor, Christmas at my house was really fun when we were very small. I remember we were poor, but boy, my family seemed to rally together and get us all the toys that we wanted. I never remembered not getting anything I wanted for Christmas when I was a kid. Now, that could also be because when I was a kid, I had very simple tastes. You know, I wanted simple things. I wanted things like dolls and doll houses and clothes. And we got those things. And I remember that on Christmas morning, my sister and I would be sitting in front of the fireplace and we'd be opening our presents. And it was great. It was really great. But what I also remember about my early days growing up was, for the most part, it was very painful. My childhood was very, very painful. And I suspect most of my drinking and using after the beginning was because I was trying to make that pain go away on some level. I remember growing up as a kid always feeling different. Always feeling different. I think if there's something, if there's one thing that I could probably use to describe how I felt as a child, it was the fact that I felt like I was different. I was on the outside looking in. It was though there was a party going on inside, And I was always outside wanting to be invited, and nobody ever invited me to the party. Ever. I remember as a kid, my grandmother was a seamstress by profession. And she used to have lots of her patrons come through the house for various fittings. And my sister and I were like the little hostesses. And, you know, they were always really sweet to us. They were always very kind and respectful. But it was at that point in my life that I realized that I was different. That I was really different. And it wasn't even so much a racial thing, although there were wealthy black families that would come and would be fitted for clothing, too. But the thing I recognized then as a child was that there was a class difference. You know, there were those that had and those that had not. And I was in that group that had not. And for the rest of my life, I was trying to be one of those that had. Just trying to be one of those that had. My family moved to New York when I was 6 years old. And for the very first time in my life, I was to experience prejudice. Not so much racial prejudice, although I felt that too as a child. But it was more the kind of prejudice that one would feel if they moved from a very backward southern community to a much more sophisticated New York town or community. And at that time, Atlanta wasn't this great cosmopolitan hub. You know, it was run by Lester Maddox, and it indeed was not a very chic community. But we moved up to New York, and I guess on some level as a child, I thought that pain of differentness would go away, but it didn't. It didn't. I was a little southern hick, and I came to New York with a very strong southern drawl. And if you can possibly imagine, I had long hair, and I had pigtails. My mother used to keep them in pigtails and kept ribbons on my head. And we were poor, so for the most part, we used to wear hand-me-downs. And it was awful. It was awful. The kids made fun of me like you would not believe. I never realized how truly cruel children could be. But as a child, I experienced that wrath. And I remember often running home, trying to get some sort of solace in my home because of the pain I had to experience at school. And I never did. I never did. My home was not a very loving one, but it was only because my mother was trying to work and to support us. It wasn't that she didn't want to be. She just couldn't at the time. And I guess if there was anybody that was looking at this little kid from the outside, anybody who had any sort of sensitivity to what was going on, probably knew that at some point I was going to try to find something to make that pain go away. Something. Didn't matter what it was, but I was going to find something that was going to erase the pain of my own reality. And my earliest escape in life as a result was literature and the silver screen. I loved books. My mother's a librarian, and we used to have reams and reams of books all over the house. I mean, every wall was full of books. They were stacked up high. It was as though every time the library wanted to get rid of stuff, they gave it to my mother and she'd ship it to the house. And it was fabulous because, you know, I'd go sit in a corner and I'd have my book with me and I just read. I just read. And I don't know if my mother thought that I was trying to become a smart kid, but what was really happening for me was that when I started to read, I was like Cinderella. When I started to read, it didn't matter what you guys thought of me. I mean, for a moment, it didn't even matter what I thought of me. When I started to read, I became somebody so special. And it was the same way with the movies. I loved movies. I loved the old movies, and I loved especially the women, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. I mean, those were my kind of women. Those are women that had a glass in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand, and they didn't take a whole lot of crap off anybody. And I needed that. Because I was a little kid with a big hole in her gut and there was no way of filling it. And at that stage of my life, I still thought you filled it with stuff from the outside. It wasn't until many years later when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized that that big hole that was in my gut had to be filled from the inside. It had to come from the inside. But at that stage of my life, I didn't know that. And I kept trying to make it go away with all these things. And I must tell you, those things worked for a while. They really did. The books and the movies managed to make me feel different. They managed to take me away from the pain of growing up in the South Bronx, growing up sleeping with rats, growing up having to eat plaster off the wall. It made that pain go away for a little while until it just stopped going away. And then I realized that instead of taking the pain of my reality away from me, it made it perfectly clear that this is where I was and I wasn't going anywhere else. That I was a poor little black kid growing up in the South Bronx, and that was it. That was my life. And it was at that time that I got introduced to the wonderful world of drugs. I don't harp on drugs because I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is how I got sober, and I'm an alcoholic primarily. But it's always important that I mention that because over the years I've seen so many people come in that have thought that being an alcoholic means it's acceptable to use other drugs. Or people I know that have come in as drug addicts thought it was acceptable to drink. And if nothing else, I took away from Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas, Nevada, 8 years ago, was that a day at a time, what you guys were teaching me was how to live in a world that I tried desperately to run away from on a daily basis without the aid of any kind of chemical. Any kind of chemical. That's what you taught me. And so it's important for me to acknowledge for myself that I don't drink today, I don't use drugs today, and I show up for my own life. But at that time, I wasn't doing that. I was using whatever I possibly could. And growing up in the 60s, it did make it very easy. You know, everybody was doing it, so it made it very, very acceptable. I'd like to tell you that my drinking was social, and if it didn't start that way, that it ended that way. But I heard a man once in Alcoholics Anonymous say that his social drinking lasted about 15 minutes. And that's about how it was for me, you know. I think it was social for the first five drinks or six drinks. And then it just left me like that. And there was no more social drinking. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about that incomprehensible demoralization. And, you know, when I got sober in the rooms here, I knew exactly what they were talking about. It's as though when I read that line, those words in the book, they jumped out at me and just grabbed a hold of my insides. I knew exactly what they were talking about when they spoke of the four horsemen. That terror, that frustration, that bewilderment, and that despair. That was what I experienced every single day of my life as a woman alcoholic. I became the kind of alcoholic that was so vile and so wretched that it was difficult for me to even look at myself in the mirror on any given day. I remember as a child, my mother used to have parties, my mother and my aunt, and there were women that used to come over to the house, and they were women that basically were really wonderful ladies. They were respectful of themselves, and they were respectful of us. And they'd come over to the house, and they'd be friendly. And somehow during the course of the evening, there would be a transformation that took place. And I wasn't too clear on why it happened, but I knew, in a sense, that when they started to party, they would start to be different. You know, their clothes would be on one side of the room. Instead of speaking like ladies, they'd start talking like vile human beings. They started to become abusive. And I noticed that in the course of an evening, and I remember saying to myself on some level, God, I'll never be like that. How could any woman let that happen to herself? I mean, how could any woman let that happen? And yet, that's the kind of woman alcoholic that I became, and worse. I became the kind of woman alcoholic that compromised herself to the point that I no longer knew I was compromising myself. I did things in my drinking and using that it took many years in Alcoholics Anonymous for me to forgive myself for. I knew what they meant when they talked about that shame. I knew what they meant when they talked about that dirt. I knew what they meant when they talked about not being able to control the way I was behaving. Because, you see, once I picked up a drink or a drug, there was no choice. There was no choice at all. Today, at 11 years sober, I've got so many choices, it blows me away, and sometimes I don't know what to do with them. But today, because I don't drink or use drugs, I have those choices. But, you know, when I was drinking and using, there was no choice. Every single moment, every day I woke up, I knew exactly what I was going to do. Exactly. Every day. It was as though the plan had already been set for me. I knew that what I had to do was to find a way to quell those habits. Every day I had to go find a drink and a drug to make sure I didn't ache all day. That's what I did. And what happened in that search for trying to be okay physically is I became the kind of person that was just unbelievable despicable, because I did things to get that drink and that drug that I never, ever thought I would ever do. I know my mother as a child, or when I was a child, my mother gave me basic values. And I know she did because in recovery, I've come to see that. And I know, as I've thought back, you know, my mother gave me the foundation for being a good person. But somewhere along the line, when I started to drink and use drugs, that just went out the window. It just went out the window. I stopped thinking about morals. I stopped thinking about values. I stopped thinking about being a good person, and I definitely stopped thinking about being a good woman, you know. I just didn't know how to do it. When I drank and used, that's all that mattered. I did whatever I had to do to get to that place. My drinking took me to places that truly I would not have wished on my worst enemy. I would not have wished on my worst enemy. In A Vision for You, what Lisa just read, it talks about those sordid companions that sometimes we seek when we get to that level. And the sad reality for this alcoholic is I became one of those sordid companions. I became one of those people that you wouldn't have wanted your daughter to hang out with, or you wouldn't have wanted your son to hang out with. That's what I had become. It was almost like a water rat. You know, you just hang out with that kind of person and that's what you become. I remember there were times when I'd come home from doing whatever it was I was doing, and the thing is that all this stuff that was happening, from the outside it looked okay, because by this stage of the game I had acquired what I thought was all important, and that were those things. You see, because I grew up so poor, the almighty dollar was the thing that guided me. And between the drugs and the alcohol and the quest for money, I just did anything I felt I had to do. And when I'd come home from doing those things, I remember taking baths. And I remember sometimes scrubbing my body so hard, trying to get the dirt off, that I would hurt myself. I'd have abrasions on my skin. And I guess if there are any of you in here that are real deal alcoholics, you know what that's about. You know that the dirt that I was trying to get off the surface just wouldn't go away. It wouldn't go away with any amount of soap and water. It wouldn't go away with any amount of fragrance. Didn't matter how many beautiful clothes I had. It didn't matter that I was living on the east side of Manhattan. It didn't matter the places I frequented or the men that I was attached to. The kind of dirt that I kept trying to wash off my body was attached to the inside. It was that kind of soul sickness that when you lie down with scum, you become one. You become that very thing you don't want to become. But because you do things on a daily basis to compromise yourself, after a while you become oblivious to the fact that it is a compromise, and you just keep doing it. And so I couldn't get that stuff off. And what that did for me was it made me want to drink more. Because the less the dirt would come off, the more I still had to cover it up. And I just continued to drink and use. In 1978, I knew that there was clearly something wrong with my life. I didn't equate it with alcohol, nor drugs, and that really surprises me, considering how I drank and used. But for the life of me, I couldn't figure it that it was booze. I just couldn't figure it out. And I started to think about these different things I wanted to do with my life, and one of my clients had suggested that I consider another line of profession, sort of. And he suggested that I... Well, in the course of conversation, it was suggested that perhaps I might enlist in the Navy. Now, I know there are people from the military here, and I truly have nothing against the military. But I have to tell you, I am so grateful I didn't make it. I am so grateful I didn't go to the Navy. But as was my pattern, I was just short of going to the Navy because I passed all the exams, you know, I did everything except show up for induction. And again, that was my pattern, not to show up. You know, just not to show up. But instead, what I did was it was suggested that perhaps I should go to a therapist. Because, again, we still couldn't figure out what was going on, but we knew something wasn't right. And this therapist had the audacity to tell me that she thought I had an allergy to alcohol. Now,
If you are the kind of alcoholic that I am, and if you're the kind of drunk that I was, you were steeped in denial. Just steeped in denial. And she said I had an allergy, so I did what any self-respecting alcoholic would do. I went to an allergist, and I got a test. And I don't know if they still do it the same way, but it was a big head with four little needles, and they prick you to see if you're allergic to anything. And of course I wasn't allergic to anything, you know. But all that did for me was continually gave me an excuse to behave the way I was behaving. And I did. I just kept doing it. Because, you see, there was nothing wrong with me. And at the same time all this was happening, I was still trying to think of things to do because something wasn't right. I didn't know, again, it was my drinking, but I knew something wasn't right. And at this time, Atlantic City had legalized gambling. They had just opened up the casinos Memorial Day in 78. And I figured, aha. And New York, by the way, was also considering legalizing gambling a couple of years down the road. So I figured in my mind that what I would do is learn how to deal, come out to Las Vegas, because that would indeed help my drinking, and then I would move back to New York and I'd be this hotshot dealer. This is what was going on in my brain in 1978, and I just want you to know I was never my best friend, and for my brain to start thinking that way, it truly let you know it was out to get me. But I did just that. I learned how to deal in New York, and I moved to Las Vegas. And interestingly enough, the person who ran the school is someone I've come to see in the rooms here, so I guess many of us make it in different ways. We make it into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I moved out to Vegas in 1978, and I did it as a geographic, and yet I didn't understand that that's what I was doing. I really didn't understand it. I mean, I thought that I moved out here to learn how to deal and to make more money, you know, and to have a better life. And plus, I wanted to get away from that old life. So that's what was on my mind when I came out here. And it took 9 months for a God that I did not believe in at the time to just say, enough of this crap. 9 months I drank and used in Las Vegas, Nevada. And it was as though I drank and used like there was no tomorrow. I was one of the first women dice dealers in a major hotel here on the Strip. And it was something I really had wanted to do for a long time, since I was living here. I mean, I worked hard to get to that place. And I almost lost that job due to my drinking and using. They had asked me to stop coming in late. They had strongly suggested that when I came in, to not leave, and that when I was there, I would be productive. They asked me that over and over again. And they gave me warning after warning after warning. And I don't even know why I got so many warnings. I don't know, but they gave them to me. And I remember one day, I was told that if I came in late again, or if I didn't show up again, I might as well just not come in because I wouldn't have a job. And I remember on this particular night, it was like a night like every other for me. I just couldn't stop drinking. I just couldn't stop drinking. I had been hanging out from the time I had gotten off from work the day before, and I just kept drinking. I was working day shift at the time, and they required 4 hours for you to call in order to not come in. And I knew at that fifth hour, I knew I wasn't going to make it. I knew I wasn't going to make it into the Hilton that day. I knew I wasn't going to make it. And yet I knew if I called in that they were going to tell me I had to quit or they were going to just fire me. And yet the more frustrated I got, the more I drank, and the more I drank, the less I was capable of going to work that morning. The less I was capable. And I remember it was the fourth hour and I realized I just couldn't make it. And I called them up on the telephone and said, I quit. And you know, it's really sad to think that that's where alcohol and drugs takes one, where you get to the point that your livelihood becomes less important than your addiction. I couldn't stop drinking, though. I just couldn't stop drinking. And so I called and quit. And one of the few friends, I guess she was probably the only friend that I had left at the very end, She lived in my complex, and she said, "Francine, I think you need to call them." This was later when I was in a little control of my faculties. She said, "I think you need to call them and make some sort of amend. I think you really need to try to do that." And I remember calling, and I had to go in, and the guy gave me my job back. But yet, you know, I would not have been able to hold on to that job because I couldn't stop drinking. And it was 2 weeks later that I got hit by a car in a blackout. And, excuse me, today I endearingly like to say that it was the best thing that ever happened to me. That a loving God that I did not believe in broke my leg in order to save my life. I think Frank was the first one that told me that. I'd like to tell you that that accident was enough to do it right away. But those of you that are real alcoholics in this room this morning know that that's not enough to stop you. A little car accident is not going to stop a real alcoholic from drinking. And so it did not. It did not. There was a man who lived upstairs from me who I hated with a passion. And he hated me equally as much. He had the legs, however, and I had the money. But I couldn't stand him because, you see, he used to sell his plasma to get money to buy alcohol. And that was like the lowest thing in the world, in my opinion. I mean, it never dawned upon me what I was selling to have to get money for drugs and booze. But this man, he was a real lowlife. And, but it didn't matter. And that's just where that alcoholism took me. It didn't matter what kind of low life he was because he had the legs and I had the money. And he would cop for me every day and I'd give him the money and we'd sit there snarling at each other. But I drank and used every day thanks to this man. And then one day, there was that moment of clarity. And even before then, I just want to share with you what was my last drunk. And it's not because it was my worst drunk, because it clearly was not. But it was about a month and a half after the accident. I had come from the doctor, and he simply refused to take my cast off. And I just thought that was the worst thing in the world. I mean, I thought I was ready to walk. I had a compound fracture, and when they found me in the street, I might add, I was in a direction opposite from my house, and they thought I'd never live. And when they realized I'd live, they never thought I'd ever walk again because my leg had come up behind my head, and the bone came straight through. And I walk around today with a nice 10-inch scar as a constant reminder of where I've come from. I mean, if for a moment I get too cocky in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I start to think I don't need to go to meetings, I start to think that I'm too good to do service. I start to think that I don't have enough time to talk to sponsees or that other things should be a priority. If for a moment I start to think that, all I need to do is look at my leg, and it's a very good reminder of where I've come from. But on this particular morning, I came to, and he wouldn't take that cast off my leg. And I remember I went to his office, and I came back, and I should have known that it was the end. I should have known. Because en route from the doctor's office, I stopped by the liquor store and I got 3 big bottles of Blue Nun. Now, I never drank Blue Nun, and I didn't like white wine in particular, but not Blue Nun especially. But I didn't even know they made it in big bottles. And I really didn't. I thought they had those little ones, and I got 3 of those bottles. And I brought them home and I drank them. Just me by myself. And the next thing I remember, I came to in an apartment that really had the potential of being beautiful. I was living in Las Palmas when I got sober, and it was a lovely complex at the time. And I'm sure it still is. And outside of my little garden apartment, it was really lovely. There was a little rolling brook, and they used to keep little ducklings inside, and it was so pretty. It was so pretty. And when you came into my apartment, it really did have the potential of being lovely, too. But it wasn't. My apartment was barren for the most part. and it smelled of animal waste, and it smelled of human waste, because I couldn't take care of myself nor my animals. I was just there. I was like hostage in my own apartment those last few days. I kept drinking and I kept using drugs. And I couldn't clean up myself. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't even get out of the bed. I was just there. I was really a pathetic sight. And it was around that time that I just had that moment of clarity. And I'm not sure what it was on this particular day when I came to, with my apartment door wide open and my crutches on one side of the room, and I was lying in my own waste in the nude. I don't know what it was that came to my brain that morning. But I guess for the first time in my life, I decided I wanted to live as opposed to wanting to die. And that decision wasn't necessarily mine, but I do believe that there was a tiny cry deep down in my gut that was begging for help. When I was newly sober, I used to think that I was one of the chosen ones. I thought that because I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was chosen, that God thought I was special. But I have stopped thinking that. Today I believe that for myself, that there was a tiny, tiny cry all the way down there that was so faint, it was so covered up by lots of noise, lots of cacophony around me. But that God heard that cry, a God I didn't even believe in at the time. But that this God heard that cry and gave me the gift of life. And on that particular day, I called Alcoholics Anonymous here in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I said, I'd like to go to a meeting. I'm on crutches and I don't have a car. And could somebody come and get me? And I don't remember the woman who was on the phone, but she said, honey, I don't think we can get somebody to you right now, but if you can hold on, we'll get somebody to take you to a meeting tomorrow. And I suspect that the God that was watching over me even then knew I was not going to make it for another day. Because shortly thereafter, I got a telephone call from a young woman, Minnie. Minnie called me up and said, I live in the complex right next door to you, and if you'd like to come to a meeting, I'll pick you up and take you. And I remember that first meeting was the Triangle Club on a Wednesday night. And I'd like to tell you that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and embraced it with open arms. I'd like to tell you that I came in and I was a shining example of what a good little newcomer would be. But the fact is, number one, if I stood up here and said that, there are enough people in here that saw me when I got sober, and they'd probably start to laugh and embarrass me. I know Madden's sitting right up front for a reason. But the fact is, I came in with a very bad attitude. And that's an understatement, I know. A very bad attitude. I used to hang out in the back of the room, what I like to now call the inventory section. And I did just that. I took everybody's inventory. I came in with the kind of attitude that, I'll tell you something, it is truly only as a result of an act of providence that I didn't pick up a drink in those first 2 years, because my attitude was bad. I hung out with the people who said, honey, all you have to do is come in and take up a seat, and you'll get this thing through osmosis. You see, I didn't like most of the people that had strong recovery, especially my sponsor. I didn't like those people that said, honey, if you want what we have, you do what we do to get it. They used to say to me that it's not enough to just come and take up a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. That indeed, if you do that, you could probably not pick up a drink or a drug for a while. But if you want to sustain any kind of recovery on any kind of level, there's going to have to come a time when you're going to do more than just not drink and take up a seat. And see, I took up three seats, which was really bad. I came in with my crutches, and I had one for my bottom, one for my leg and one for my crutches, and I dared anybody to say anything to me. I mean, I'd sit in Duffy's and I'd sit at the Triangle and I'd prop my leg up and people would need seats. I just had a bad attitude. I came in with a real cavalier attitude, like I was better than, and God only knows how I thought that, you know, I mean, crawling up from the gutter. But I guess it was because I thought, being from New York, it made me somebody different. I don't know. I was different, all right. But they kept, they stuck with me. And maybe that's why I love Las Vegas like I do. They never, ever gave up on me. They never said, Francine, you are so bad that we want you to leave right now. They never said that. They just kept saying in their little snide way, keep coming back, honey. And I kept coming back. I kept coming back. I remember Louise would say to me that it's not an accident that there's an entire chapter in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous called Into Action. She said, it is not a mistake. She said, you think you can just slide through here? She said, it is not a mistake, furthermore, that in that chapter called Into Action, you will find most of our 12 steps discussed. And she said, even more than that, it's not a mistake that in that chapter you're going to find the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, that was another cute one for me. The promises, when I finally learned where they were, I would totally omit the first line, and I didn't want to know about the last line either. The first line that says, if we are painstaking about this phase, and the last line that says, if you work for these things, they will materialize. Anything that required action on my part, I didn't want to do it. I wanted to sit back and just let you do it for me. And I remember somebody called me on that once when I was new, and it really pissed me off because, I mean, I was like on crutches, you know? And I was like a helpless person. And every now and then, somebody would call me on that stuff, and I really resented it, you know. And as a result, I have to tell you, I didn't like anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was trying to think for a moment, but I didn't like my sponsor in particular, because all she ever did was talked about action, gratitude, God, and service. And it didn't matter what I called Louise to talk about. All she would ever tell me is that I should be grateful. She'd talk about God. She'd talk about get up off your behind and do some service or something. It's like, I didn't want to hear that stuff, you know. And then when they railroaded me into doing service at this conference for the first time 11 years ago, I remember I sat back and I just was so miserable. I was so miserable. I was like 3 or 4 months sober and I was on my crutches and I wanted somebody to feel sorry for me. And instead, all they did was focused on the speakers and everything that was going on around me, but not me. And I couldn't even get anybody to get me coffee or something. It was awful. It was awful. But I kept showing up. I got active, even in spite of myself. I remember Frank Madden was one of the first people who really got me to be a part of this program, and I didn't like him very much either. He was from New York, too, and he was one of those tough guys that I didn't really like. But he always got me involved in service. He got me active in the Young People's Roundup and Alcoholics Anonymous when I was brand spanking new. And you know, it's those very early things that I did, thanks to you guys, that have made me the woman that I am today. Every single thing I've done over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, has enabled me to deal with life the way I've been able to deal with it, especially in the last couple of years. All the stuff you taught me. I stuck around for 2 years like that. And then there was something that happened in my recovery. It was something that happened inside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I talk about it today, it's so, for me, it's very poignant because it's so special. For the first time, I guess I started to understand what you guys meant when you talked about coming to believe. Because up until this point, I didn't believe in anything. I had no hope. And I guess the beginning glimpses of hope came when I saw that you were staying sober no matter what. And when I saw that you didn't give up on me no matter what. But at this point, I realized that I needed something more, that I really needed to have some kind of faith of my own. And I remember going to Louise saying, but I don't know how to pray. I don't know any prayers. Because, you see, I had ostracized God many, many years before. I grew up with the God of my childhood being the God of hellfire and brimstone. I grew up a Southern Baptist. And so I didn't want to know about God when I got sober. It was really difficult to swallow that G word. And I remember when I came in, she just kept saying, act as if. She would say to me, in the morning, ask for the ability not to pick up a drink or to pick up a drug, or in your case, not to compromise yourself just for the day. And she would tell me at the end of the day, if I found I didn't drink, and if I found out I didn't drug, and if I found out for that one 24-hour period I didn't compromise myself as a woman, to just say thank you. And that was how my prayers began. Asking for help and just saying thank you. She also suggested that I read on page 86 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where there are two prayers. There's one upon awakening and there's one upon retiring. Excuse me. And I remember every day I would just read those two prayers from the book. I didn't know what I was reading, and I really didn't believe in it, but I just kept reading it. And you know, the day came when I realized I was no longer acting as if. I mean, the day came when I realized that I actually was starting to believe in some power greater than myself, something other than the bag or the bottle or a man, you know, because that was always my God. I was always an appendage of all the men in my life. I never knew what real self-esteem was like. It was always contingent on the men that I was with. But at this point, I started to believe in some power greater than myself, something that was intangible, which made it so weird. I couldn't touch it. I couldn't see it. But I started to believe. And as a result, I'm one of those people in Alcoholics Anonymous that really believes that there was no mistake why step two was placed right up top in our steps. It's not a mistake. I believe when it says in the Big Book that lack of power was my dilemma, and that what I needed was to find some power greater than myself that was going to help me deal with life. That's what it says in the Big Book. That's what it says. And that's what I found. I started to believe. Working in concert at the same time was that I was coming to a bottom in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I could no longer behave the way I was behaving for those first 2 years and stay sober. I mean, it was really that simple for me. I like to think that I was sicker than most people because I couldn't have lasted another moment. I just couldn't. I was beaten into a state of reasonableness in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 2 years sober. That, coupled with God, was the beginning of a life that is so unbelievable. That changing of my attitude, I came to discover, was really about step three for me. You know, before then, I thought that step three was only applicable to my drinking and my using. You know, I thought it was okay that you guys said to me, don't drink, and that I did it. That was sufficient. But for the life of me, I didn't want you to tell me how to live my life. I didn't want you to tell me it was unacceptable to come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with see-through blouses on. You know, I didn't want you to tell me that it was unacceptable to come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and curse all of, you know, like a sailor. I didn't want you to tell me that if I wanted self-esteem, I had to do esteemable acts. See, I didn't want to hear that stuff. I wanted to play with the boys. I wanted to do this. I wanted to do everything I wasn't supposed to do in the beginning. It got to that point in Alcoholics Anonymous where I had to let you help me learn how to live. I did an inventory around this time, and it was my own for the very first time in my whole life, I might add. I had never taken my own inventory, ever. It was so much easier, of course, to take yours. And I remember I went... Number one, I remember it was very difficult to actually do that because I, like a lot of people, had been influenced by a lot of the stuff I heard in the rooms. You know, everybody was so scared of their fourth step, and so I was scared too. But my sponsor kept saying to me that there are three steps that come before step four, and there are steps that come after step four, and that they're all about conditioning steps. She used to say to me over and over again that one through three condition you for number four, as four conditions you for all the, you know, for five and five, I mean, on down the line. And so by the time I went to Louise armed with my fourth step, I guess I was about as ready as I was going to be. And I shared my fifth step. I shared my fifth step with her. And what came out of that for me was just one of the most phenomenal experiences. One of the most important things that came out of that sharing was my mother. I hated my mother all of my life. This was a woman that if somebody said I looked like her or I sounded like her, I wanted to just stick a dagger in them. I felt like they were sticking daggers in me. You know, I hated this woman. We were always in competition with one another. And you know what? I've come to realize it wasn't even that we were in competition with one another. I was in competition with her. I was too big for my britches at a very early age. And my mother did the best she could with what she had, trying to take care of a kid like me. But what came out of that fourth and fifth for me was that my mother really did do the best she could with what she had. That she was really a wonderful, wonderful person. And, you know, when I set out on this path, I didn't plan that a lot of the things that happened would happen. But today my mother is one of my best friends. And it is really awesome when I think about that. She's one of my biggest fans. And I love her dearly. But it was really important that that I work through that with her because I realized as long as I hated her, every single relationship I had was going to be tainted, whether it was with a man or a woman. Every single relationship was marred because of how I felt about my mother. And when I was able to work through that stuff with her, I was able to not only forgive her but forgive myself and see that she truly was doing the very best she could. Something else that came out of that fifth for me was the fact that I was actually able to share a piece of my life, something that I thought I would go to the grave with another woman. I learned about trust through that fifth step. I learned how to be naked in front of another woman and share just who I was as best as I could at the time. And that was really a major deal for me because I hated women so much. I came in here like a lot of women I know, and I hated women. I remember the women that would speak in the meetings, especially the ones that were pretty and the ones that had any kind of recovery, I hated them with a passion. I mean, it's like they'd get up to the podium and talk, and I just wanted to slice them up. And what I realized was it wasn't that I hated them. It was that I hated myself so much. I mean, I really wanted what you guys had, but I was too self-absorbed, if you will, to ask you for help. It was easier to take your inventory than to ask you to show me how you did it. So when I did my fifth step with Louise, it was really important because for the first time I was able to share that with another woman, and it brought me closer to myself as a woman and to others. What also came out of that fifth step for me was about forgiveness of Francine. I was able to see a lot of that stuff that I had done, and I realized for the very first time in my life that I was not a bad person trying to get good, but I was really a very sick woman that was just trying to get well. That was all. Just very sick. I'm one of those people who, in Alcoholics Anonymous, thought that step six and seven... were not really important steps. I kind of thought they were fillers. I thought that Bill W. had nothing else to stick in those two slots. And I really believe this. I really believe that being entirely willing, you know, was like nothing. And I'm going to tell you, I am so grateful I stuck around long enough for the fog to lift for me to realize how vitally important those two steps are. As a matter of fact, for this alcoholic, they were an imperative. Because it wasn't enough to just illuminate that stuff through the fourth step, and it wasn't enough just to share it with someone else. If I was going to hold on to all those things that made me drink in the first place and made me act out, I was going to continue to do that. I was going to continue to behave. And if I didn't change, the woman that came in here that drank would have drank again. Even today, when I read in the back of the sixth step, it says something that just grips my insides. It says that delay is dangerous and rebellion may be fatal. And even today when I read that, it's as though they're talking to me. Step eight for me was, for the most part, came from my fourth step inventory list. However, over the years, more people were added. And it was much more difficult for me to do an eighth step than it was for me to actually do a ninth step. Because, you see, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous really thinking that I had not harmed anyone. I had never been married. I had no children. And so I really believed that I didn't do anything to warrant an amend. And furthermore, I thought that most people owed me amend. You know, those guys that I was with, they did me wrong. I mean, they made me behave the way I behaved. They offered me money. They did all these things. They forced me to behave that way. You do understand that, and I believe that. I really believed it. And again, I'm so grateful that I stuck around long enough to know that indeed there were amends I had to make. My mother was the top of that list, but there were lots of others. There were lots of others. And I must say today, just about all of them have been made, the ones that I'm aware of. There have been some that I've tried to make, and they have not been around. But I can tell you today that I am willing. One of the amends that I made, and I just want to share this because I know a lot, I hear quite often people say, I don't want to make the amend because I'm afraid of what's going to happen. Well, I was taught that, number one, the amend steps were important, that I had to do them. But more than that, that it was about cleaning up my side of the street. That it wasn't about what you guys had done to me, it was what I had done. And even if you were 99.10% wrong, if I had anything to do with it, I had to clean up my side of the street. And this man I tried to make an amend to, he had been an ex-boyfriend of mine. I remember calling him up on the telephone and he hung up. And you know, I have to tell you that I was not nearly as devastated as I thought I was going to be had something happened like that. Because by the time I was willing to make that amend, I was willing. I really was willing. And it didn't matter what the outcome was. I was willing. I have tried to incorporate the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life on a daily basis. And I like to think that the example of how I live and what I've done in my recovery is indicative of that. You guys have shown me through the steps of this program that anything's possible. That anything's possible. And you see, I didn't believe that when I came in here. I really didn't. I've received lots of gifts in recovery. And again, the most important gift for me was the gift of a power greater than myself. It was that gift of God that is the most special gift beyond any other. But there have been lots of others. And one of the special gifts for me has been the ability to look at myself in the mirror. Really has. To be able to like the woman that I am today. Today I am not a woman that feels shame. Today, where dirt used to be how I felt, dirty used to be how I felt before inside, today I feel clean all over. Because that's the kind of woman I am today. I live in a decent way. Today I don't sleep with other people's husbands. Today I don't even covet other people's husbands. And you know, that's a real big thing for me because that was like commonplace. And I thought nothing of it. Today I don't curse, and that's a big thing for me too. Again, I was taught that if you want self-esteem, you have to do esteemable acts, and I learned that early on. And I remember one of the first times I came to Louise to talk, every other word she kept saying to me was like a curse word. She said, "Do you know anything else?" And, you know, I realized that it wasn't so much that I didn't know other words, but I had such low self-esteem that I wanted to take the focus off of what I was saying and put it on me, because, you see, I never thought what I had to say was important. I never thought what I had to say was important. Today, I have made a concerted effort over the years not to use that language, and that's just for me. And I feel good about it. I can hold a conversation with someone today without spewing out a lot of curse words. That self-esteem also manifests itself in how I carry myself today as a woman, how I carry myself as a person, the things I do, the fact that I could stand up for myself, the fact that I can work through fear when I never thought I could. Fear was my middle name when I got sober. I was afraid of my own shadow. And a day at a time, through the grace of God in this program, I've learned how to walk through that fear, and in walking through it, I've developed self-esteem. When I was 2 years sober, I was 28 years old, I realized I wanted to do something with my life, and I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. And I started to pray to this newfound God, and I got different kinds of answers. And I remember Louise used to say to me always, when you pray for answers, pray to be open-minded. Because, you see, I had a tendency to be tunneled vision. You know, when I prayed for answers, I wanted the answer to take the right shape, the right size, the right color. It had to be just right. And as a result, I missed all the answers because they were out here somewhere. But at this particular time, I prayed for answers. And God put two women in my life. One was one of our speakers, our young people speaker. I think it was our first or second year that I was here. It was June G out of Los Angeles. And she was 21 years old when I met her, and she was 7 years sober, and she was in her second year at UCLA Law School. And the other woman that God put in my life was a woman from here. Her name was Lynn S. And Lynn had gone back to school. She was 30. And she wanted to do hotel administration. And that was just awesome. I mean, more than anything else, Lynn really blew me away because she was 30 years old. And I was 28, and I thought I was over the hill. I thought I could never go to school. But I would go and sit in on her classes. She let me audit her classes, and I'd sit in with her. And, you know, I found that I had this appetite for knowledge. And that, I might add, was also working in concert with what was happening to me in the rooms. Because, you see, I couldn't really read when I got sober. I was so ashamed of that. It was very sad. They would give me things to read in Alcoholics Anonymous, and instead of saying, "I can't pronounce this word," I would storm out of the room with a bad attitude. You know, they'd give me the traditions to read, and I couldn't pronounce anonymity. And so I would just storm out of the room. And I could never say, "Would you help me pronounce this word?" I was too ashamed. There was a man yesterday who spoke in one of the marathons, and he was saying he got put in jail for it. 8 years because he couldn't read the sign. He went to rob a bank, and it said something about change, and he couldn't read it. So he got sentenced to 8 years in prison because he couldn't read. And you know, where everyone laughed, and it was funny, I stopped and I thought for a moment, I understood what that was about. I knew what that was about, that feeling of shame where I couldn't admit I couldn't read. So it was easier to pretend that I was just a malcontent. But at this stage, I wanted to learn how to read. And Louise would say, "Get a dictionary next to you." And every time I came across a word in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, or the 12 and 12 that I didn't understand, I'd look it up. Words like rapacious, words like vicissitude, words I never had heard of before. But I read and I learned them, and I started to audit her classes, and I really discovered I wanted to learn more. But the thing is, I didn't have a high school diploma, so how do you do anything? And I had the nerve at that stage of my life to decide I wanted to do something with my life that was going to require a serious commitment. I mean, we're talking about 7, and it ended up taking 8 years of a commitment. It's taken 9 and a half, really. But I don't even know how I thought that I wanted to do something like that with my life. And I must tell you that there were a lot of people here that laughed at me. they thought that I was kind of crazy. And I don't blame them, because I guess if I was looking at me too, I might have thought so too. I mean, I was 28, no high school diploma, and I wanted to do what with my life? But there were a couple of people that just kept saying, honey, you can do anything you want to do if you're willing to do the footwork. You can do anything you want to do. That the sky's the limit. If you don't drink, and if you don't use drugs, and if you believe that God's going to get you through and you do the work, you can do anything you want to do. And so a day at a time, I set out to do this thing. And I remember buying a GED book, and I used to hide it under my bed whenever company would come, because I didn't want anybody to know I hadn't gotten out of high school. Because I used to lie. I mean, a lot. And I used to tell people that I had a year of college, and I don't know if most people in Vegas believed me or they just kept praying a day at a time. If I came back, I'd make amends for the lies. But I kept studying the book, and I went to college here at UNLV the first year, and then I moved back to New York in 1982. And for 5 years, I worked my way through college. I worked full-time. I went to school full-time. I was a plumber. I did whatever I had to do to pay for school, short of what I used to do before. You know, I remember when I first became a plumber, it was like the talk of Vegas. I was a plumber. I was an apprentice. But I studied, and I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And I share that especially because I've come to see so many people in the rooms that have gotten a little courage, that have started to flex their AA muscles, and they have a tendency to forget how it is they're able to flex those AA muscles. I've seen them not go to meetings anymore, you know, because school is more important, or because the job is more important, or because the relationship is more important. And I have to tell you, you guys trained me well, because even today in my 12th year, I'm in meetings every day. But especially during school, I was there, and I remained active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remained active. And I got through school, and I graduated from college in 1986, and I moved down to Washington, D.C. to complete my education. And last May of 1989, I graduated from one of the top law schools in this country. And I'll tell you, it may not do anything for a lot of people in here, but it does a whole lot for me. I'm the kid who used to pay lawyers a fortune to keep me out of jail. I'm the one that came in here so hopeless that there was no such thing as a dream. How do you have dreams? I didn't know what it was like to dream. But what you've given me a day at a time is the ability to dare to dream. But more than that, the ability to make those dreams come true. I'd like to tell you that it was smooth sailing after I graduated from Georgetown, and that I got the right job and I passed the bar and it was perfect. But many of you know it wasn't. I sat at the New York bar the first time on my 10th anniversary, and I thought that because I sat for the bar on my 10th anniversary, that I was going to pass it. I mean, wouldn't you think that too? But I didn't. I failed the bar the first time, and I sat for the bar the second time this past February, and I failed the bar again. And I sat for the bar again in July, the day before my 11th anniversary. And I have to tell you, I did not want to do it. I don't know how I got the strength to show up and sit for that exam for the third time. And yet I do know how. I got the strength from that power greater than myself that I have come to believe in, that's more important to me today than breathing. But more than that, I got it from you guys. I got support from all over the country. I had people calling me and sending me letters from everywhere. Every state I visited, I mean, people were rallying behind me.
And you guys gave me the courage to walk into that exam for the third time. When I really didn't want to do it. I wanted to give up so badly. I felt ashamed. I felt embarrassed. For a moment I felt stupid, but then I have to tell you that quickly dissipated. But you gave me the courage to show up for yet the third time. And a couple of weeks ago, I knew the exam scores were out. And I was, I must tell you, I really handled it very well this last time, thanks to you guys and God. I was more in the moment than I have ever been in my entire life over the last 3 months, waiting for the results, until the very end. And I remember I got that letter in the mail, and I was so afraid to open it up. Because, you see, I've come to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous that things turning out okay doesn't mean that they're going to turn out my way, but that they still are okay. Because, you see, I even understand today why I had to fail the bar. I really have come to understand a lot of that. There were some lessons that I had to learn. And had I passed the bar the first time, I wouldn't have learned them. I just wouldn't have. Had I gotten that right job and got through the exam the first time, I would have never learned what I had to learn. For a while there, I was having a tendency to forget who was really in control. Humility was kind of slipping away. And this was a reminder of who was really in control, that it wasn't me, that it was that power greater than myself that was really the one who needed the credit. But also what came out of my understanding of why I had to fail was because I needed to come down off that AA pedestal, a pedestal that I might add I helped to create. And in failing, I was forced into a place where I had to ask for help from the very people that I was rendering help to. I went to my home group and they carried me through it. And I shared constantly every step of the way. I became just one of the AAers. You know, and it was really dynamite, I must tell you. And then I guess maybe my God thought I learned a few of those lessons. Because when I opened up that letter a couple of weeks ago, it said, "Congratulations, you have passed the New York State Bar." I suspect that was one of the most important days of my life. Right up there with the day I got sober, the day I graduated from law school, the day I sat for the bar the first time. I don't know what God has in store for me for the next 11 years. I really don't. I have not a clue. But I know a day at a time, if I keep showing up and doing the things that you guys have taught me to do over the years, God, it's like, look out. Really look out. If I have a fraction of what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 11 years, in the next 11 years, I'm a lucky, lucky woman. A very lucky woman. I'm so grateful to be here and to be alive and to be sober. Today I'm the kind of woman that can walk into any room and I can hold my head up high and I can run with the best of you. Today I'm the kind of woman that really feels clean inside, because that's the way I live. Today I live in a way that's respectful. I respect myself and other people respect me today. I'm a walking, talking, living example of what Alcoholics Anonymous can do in your life if you're willing to do the footwork. So, just willing to do the footwork. The fact that I can even stand up here before you this morning is a testament to this program. The fact that you invited me is even more of a testament. In closing, I'd like to read something from AA-approved literature, for those of you that are truly purists. This is As Bill Sees It, which is my most favorite book in the world, as you can probably see. It's all tattered and torn, and it's been with me for the years I've been in recovery. And I like to always end with this passage because it so characterizes how I feel today and where I'm at.
It's entitled, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our experience, of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And you've given me the gift of choice. You've taught me that it doesn't matter that I'm black. It doesn't matter that I'm a woman. That it doesn't matter that I grew up in poverty. It doesn't matter that I've led the kind of colorful life that I've led. You've taught me that it doesn't matter where I've come from at all. That the only thing that matters is where I'm headed. And that a day at a time, if I keep showing up, the sky is the limit. Thank you for my recovery.